What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
I am your host, Kat Brooks. Our guest today is Samer Arabi, Associate Director of Political Education and Research at the Center for Constitutional Rights. He's also a member of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, or AROC, and co-founder of AROC Action. Over the weekend and into Monday, fighting between the United States and Iran intensified. Three U.S. servicemen are dead and one is missing. There have been nine straight nights of fighting. Good morning, Samer. Good to see you.
Morning, Kat. Always good to be here.
Because I believe in transparency. I opened up my little script and realized I forgot to do all of my numbers about how many people have been murdered. So we will probably get to that a little bit later. I actually want to start with Trump's clip about why we are in the middle of nine straight nights of fighting. Let's hear what the orange guy has to say, shall we?
Can't wait.
Let's roll that tape, Kirsten. Please. Okay, she needs just a second to. So we're gonna talk about Iran, of course, first, and then Samer. Just I can prep you while we're waiting for the clip. We're gonna
That'd
go
be great.
into. You got jokes this morning, right on. Syria, actually. Okay. And history, why the country is placed on the terrorist list, and some interesting developments and what that all means for positionality in the region.
Great. Looking forward to it.
Yes. All right. Let's hear the orange dude first thing in the morning, because that's what we all need. I hope you have your coffee. Let's do it.
This is a far bigger job that we're doing. We were doing a little job of stopping them from having a certain capability. Now we're just ending it. So it's really not the same thing. What we're doing now is we're ending any chance where they could have a nuclear missile. If you look at it, after a week and a half, not 4 weeks, a week and a half, 2 weeks, we stopped them from probably, but I don't want to have the word probably.
Incredible. I hadn't heard that. Incredible.
Deanna Martinez, the producer, finds the best clips. Besides cackling, your response about the bigger job that they're doing?
I mean, it's you know, very believable, because he's never said that before. This is the first time ever that he's claimed that they've actually degraded Iran's Iranian like nuclear weapons program. There was a year ago where he said that they had completely eliminated it. And then again, when they started this round of the war, they said they had completely eliminated it. But this time, they're going to completely eliminate it. Totally. I mean, it's incredible that they can just say the same thing again and again and again. And surely there's diminishing returns here, right? Like, fewer and fewer people must be believing this. It's proven by the U.S.'s own military experts that that is an impossible ask, right? Iran's military program, to the extent that it still exists, its nuclear program, to the extent that it still exists, is, you know, hundreds of feet underground, much of it bombed underground, meaning that it's totally inaccessible. So, like, what's the plan here? There isn't actually a plan here. Not only is it militarily inconceivable, but if folks remember the ceasefire that was signed, that obviously has been completely broken for the past 9 days now, I think, specifically said that Iran had a right to continue to enrich uranium. So, like, you know, the U.S. has flopped on its own head here, where it originally said that there's no way that that Iran can enrich its own uranium, to okay, it does have a right to enrich its own uranium, to now we're going to make sure that they don't enrich their own uranium. So we'll see where this goes, but I can tell you where it doesn't go. Quite definitively, this doesn't end with the United States, you know, quote unquote, ending the Iranian nuclear program. That's an inconceivable outcome at this point.
Asking people to be inside of the head of a madman is a futile experiment, but I always like your answers. So we're going to do that again. So real spit though, because I think it's too simplistic, but I could be wrong. Maybe it is this simplistic, right? When I go online and I hear what, you know, Americans are saying and say, oh, it's all about the oil. Is it all about the oil? Is that why we're, is it all about the oil? I have a feeling it's about more than that, but you know, I could be wrong. You're smarter than me about this stuff. Is it all about the oil?
First of all, no, I'm not. And secondly, I mean, you know, I definitely not, right? I think as with everything, even the Iraq war and all those things that people, you know, you could make a very compelling case about the extent to which oil is important. And none of those were just about the oil. And that's not to like, you know, undercut the extent to which oil is actually a really important factor here. It absolutely is. In many ways, I think it's the main card that Iran itself is playing. Mm-hmm. And there's a fascinating... we can eat up the rest of the hour talking about what's going on with the global oil market and why it's behaving in these really weird ways. You know, we've cut off like a giant chunk of the world's oil supply, like that just isn't flowing at this moment. And we being both the United States and Iran, and like prices aren't moving in the way that you'd expect them to. But yeah, sorry, I'm going into Wonkaville there.
I'm about to have you continue that, but finish your sentence because I'm about to fact check my kid on the radio because I'm that kind of mom.
I love it. I love it. All right. But just to say, I think, you know, there's a series of things going on here, but the, you know, I would say among the most primary, you know, we can talk about, there's a bunch of different lenses here, right? We can look at the sort of like global economic order and what the United States is trying to do in terms of shoring up its sort of rapidly collapsing economic supremacy. There's this sort of socio-political angle where we can see the sort of role that Israel and the United States are playing together to sort of establish regional hegemony and supremacy for the Israeli state. I would say particularly after the collapse of the, you know, so-called Abraham Accords, where Israel was hoping to normalize relations with the Arab world. And after, you know, years of genocide now, that's become inconceivable. So instead of being a partner to all of these Gulf Arab states, it's now trying to be the like supreme political order. And part of that is undercutting Iran, which is one of the other regional powers. There's also, I would say, even like a psychological order. There's like a shame element here, right? Where Iran, Cuba, Venezuela, these countries that the U.S. is targeting are countries that have embarrassed the United States on the global stage. And I think that's not an insignificant piece, particularly for an extremely vain president whose brain is rapidly becoming soup. Like that's not an insignificant motivating factor, I think, in this moment. Nor, I would say, you know, in the history of U.S. empire. But again, well, that's a story unto itself.
Right. That's
oh yeah.
Haiti.
Oh
it's
man.
Why Haiti is where it is at. It is punishment for the overthrow of enslavement.
Without question. Yeah. Right?
And refusal to stop trying to push back on white supremacist invasion of its country. Actually, my daughter's about to fact check me. So my daughter's in college. She's very smart. She's very smart. And for parents with your kids either on their way to college or in college, this is a thing where they go and they take these classes and they come back and they tell you things.
I love
because,
it.
You know, there's no way that you know. When she took her Black Marxism class, that was, you know, joy in
hell.
I know you didn't know this, mom, but anyway, but she sometimes she says things I'm like, oh wow, no, I didn't know that. And one of the things that my beautiful daughter, my very very smart saving the world through ocean conservation kid, is doing is she said I don't understand why the cutting off of the Strait of Hormuz is impacting U.S. gas prices, because we don't get the majority of our oil from that region of the world. Is she right? Is that true? And if it is true, then why are our prices so high?
That's a really, it's a super good question.
I'm gonna tell you said that.
It's a really good question. And frankly, one people aren't asking enough, right? Like the oil price thing is fascinating. It's also like, I would say possibly the core Iranian strategy for winning this war is to make it economically and politically unfeasible for the United States to continue. And a key piece of that is raising the price of oil so much that the global cost of this war is just unbearable. And I will say, first of all, as I understand it, I'm not a, you know, oil and gas expert, but as
we
I understand it,
wouldn't be friends if you were.
Yeah, fair enough. That statement is true. The United States almost, you know, overwhelmingly uses its own oil, right? And particularly since this is an Obama development where they sort of, you know, opened up this
fracking, shale, kind of whatever oil development stuff that massively changed the game. It turned the U.S. into a massive oil importer, into one of the world's biggest oil exporters. So it's true. The United States, by the by, isn't really using a lot of oil that's coming out of the Strait of Hormuz. But that doesn't mean that global oil shocks don't impact the price of domestic oil. It absolutely does. You will notice that the U.S. is feeling it less intensely than it is in a lot of other places, say, like, you know, Southeast Asia in particular, and now even in Europe, where you're actually encountering shortages. So far, the U.S. hasn't encountered any shortages, but they still might. And, you know, the oil industry predicts that the U.S. is on its way to shortages if this war continues for another few months, which is fascinating because, again, the U.S. produces all the oil that it needs. But we live in capitalism, which means that the people producing the oil don't care whether or not it's going to people in the United States, right? They're selling it to the highest bidder. And so if the entire global market for oil prices is going up, then people are selling that oil to whoever is willing to pay the most. And right now, that's still enough to cover U.S. needs. But as oil shortages continue, and I think a key piece here is, you know, the U.S. has this strategic petroleum oil reserve, right, that it that's had since 1973 as a response to the oil shock from the, you know, the Israeli Syrian Egyptian war back then. And it's dipping into that massively. And that's one of the big reasons that we're able to maintain a sort of stable oil infrastructure in the United States. But you can only dip into reserves so much, right? And even when you're dipping into reserves, you also are sort of forcing the future to put oil back into the reserve, which is going to be very expensive. So it's an unsustainable process. And since we're wonking out on oil stuff, a little tidbit that I think a lot of folks listening to this think they know, and I thought I knew until very recently, but turns out not to be the case, that 1973 shock, you know, the story is typically that, you know, because the Arab Gulf states were very upset about U.S. support for Israel in the 1973 war, that they cut off oil to the United States, right? And that led to these like massively ballooning oil prices, right? This is the commonly known, like the Arab oil shock that has really changed the world economy in many ways. But it turns out that the Arabs actually never stopped sending oil. It was U.S. oil companies that used the pretext to jack up the prices. It's something that I had never known before. And I was like, there's no way that's true. That sounds like a conspiracy theory, but it's true. The Arab countries talked about cutting off oil reserves, U.S. oil companies using it as an opportunity to like massively increase their profits. We're just like, oh, you know what? If people think there's going to be an oil shock, let's give them an oil shock. And then they turned off all of the delivery of domestic oil in the United States. It's a crazy story.
Oh, but our homie in the southern part of the state, Dr. Malina Abdullah, says, I am not a conspiracy theorist. I'm a conspiracy realist.
Exactly.
Listen, or what Tarha used to say, just because, or no, it's not Tarha. There's a saying, something about just because you think they're following you doesn't mean you're paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
So guess is up. Jaden is actually going to be here today, and I'm going to replay this for her. She'll be very happy, except for she hates when I talk about her on the air, but it'll be your take. Anyway, guess is up. And more U.S. servicemen have been killed. And actually, our search engines are so narcissistic that actually while you were talking, I was trying to get the stats that I normally start the show with. And because we recently have lost United States servicemen, I can't even, like, I'm going to have to go down a rabbit hole to try to find out how many Palestinians and Iranians and Lebanese have been murdered. I will get there by 9 a.m. Howsomever, more U.S. servicemen have been killed. Americans don't like when, right? We are not a country that likes when our people die. Everybody else is okay, but not our folks. Those two things, gas and dead U.S. servicemen, good or bad, that's a rhetorical question, for Republicans ahead of midterm elections this fall, and how should people that are working on the left exploit this these facts, two things.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really remarkable moment where no one wants this, right? Like, no one wants this. This war that is so plainly and so clearly, as you said right at the top, for nothing. Right? Like the pretext of it being to stop an Iranian nuclear program is just an absurd one, which incidentally, the Iranian government themselves have been like, yeah, okay, we won't make nuclear weapons, but we'll still, enrich uranium. So like there's barely any pretext for this war at this point. It not for nothing, this war is less popular than the Iraq War was 10 years in, just to give you a sense of how wildly unpopular this is. And that produces a lot of opportunities, I think, because people don't want to see folks dying. They don't want to see the massive increase in prices. I'm sure folks here are feeling it at the grocery stores, right? It's not just the increase in the price of oil, it's the blocking off of fertilizer, which is having this massive global impact on food prices, among other things. So we're all feeling it, and we're feeling it in a really, really deep way. This is, people died from Iranian missiles, and people are going to die from these increased prices. There's no question, right? Like, we're making basic living needs unaffordable. And folks should be able to organize around that, right? This is the opportunity to really, it's been a remarkable moment of clarity in terms of how US foreign policy, which is often understood as a thing that the United States does to people over there, actually is not something that is distinct from its domestic policy, which is what happens to us here, right? That distinction doesn't actually really exist. And this has been a really amazing way for people to see that and to really feel that. And, I don't want to reduce what's happening just to, increased prices and US service members. Obviously, hundreds of Iranians are also being killed. The environmental damage from these attacks on oil sites and whatnot is going to be felt for generations.
There's a ship on fire in the strait, or there was a ship on fire in the strait.
Yeah, happening incidentally, during a record-breaking heat wave around the world. It's not a coincidence. But it's a really good opportunity for folks to understand that and to do something to mobilize around it, right? And so one thing that happened last week, the week before, unfortunately, my brain is also turning into soup, that the National Defense Authorization Act, which, is sort of a pro forma thing that gets signed every year by Congress overwhelmingly, this year included a new integration of the United States military with the Israeli military, basically a way of circumventing the fact that aid to Israel has become so toxic, right? The stink of it has now made basically any Democrat and even some Republicans unable to vote for something like that. The way they've gotten around that, we've talked about this in past rounds of this together, Kat. The way they've gotten around that is to come up with this like military integration thing that looked like it was going to pass. Everyone expected it to sail through, even though, we'd been calling senators and whatever nonstop. It got killed in the Senate by the Democrats because the war restarted, and they knew that those two things combined weren't going to be able to be a package that they could sell to their constituents. And so, like, that's a remarkable moment, right? That's an absolutely remarkable moment. And stopping those military integrations is critical. Now, we haven't fully stopped it because the NDAA is going to pass at some point. The question is what's going to be in it. So making that pressure something that continues to be put on to our elected representatives, using the midterms, I would say, really critically to push for candidates who are willing to stand up against these things, and for folks running for re-election, right, who are scared about that, who need to shore up support. This is a really good opportunity to push people to be like, look, this war that everybody hates, what are you going to do, right? Not only to stop the war, but to make sure wars like this don't happen again. And the fact that, Israel is playing a really outsized role in keeping this war going, why do we allow that, and why do we continue to fund this country that's undermining our own interests in such critical ways? And, we can also go down a whole path on how much of this is a US thing, how much of this is an Israeli thing. I think it's really important that we always understand Israel as like a colonial outpost of the United States. It's not a tail wagging the dog kind of thing. And we live in an empire in decline, and so sometimes our colonial outposts have outsized power on a, administration that basically isn't functioning at this point. So a lot of different pieces there, but people are seeing them. People are seeing them in ways that they weren't before, and I think that's a remarkable opportunity for folks.
Our guest today is Samer Arabi, Associate Director of Political Education and Research at the Center for Constitutional Rights, a member of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, and co-founder of AROC Action. Okay, I am not going to run out of time today. The United States, I mean, I am eventually, but not before we get to this. The United States has removed Syria from the international terrorism list. I think, I don't know, as I was getting ready to holler at you, that the significance, there's some significance in how Syria landed on that list in the first place, right? With sort of one thing and then a compounded thing. So if I'm reading history correctly, Jimmy Carter, that president that left people love to idealize, accused Syria of supporting, I'm dumb air quotes, you can't see me, all terrorists, particularly, wait for it, Palestinian ones. And B, then Syria was accused of supporting militants, again, air, people that had the nerve to defend themselves during the Iraqi war. Correct? This is like the sort of the two boom booms. And then didn't we bomb the crap out of Syria because we said that we were bombing for ISIS and Al-Qaeda? I feel like I covered that.
Oh, yeah, massively. That was one of the big Obama campaigns, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Is all of that correct? We're filling the blanks. I'm going somewhere with this.
Yeah, I mean, that's spot on. And I think that, you know, despite the fact that Syria actually tried to sort of cozy up to the Bush administration back during the Iraq war because, you know, they were scared of the U.S. coming after them next, it became very clear in the sort of neocon agenda that Syria was, in fact, next. You know, if folks remember, Syria got added to the so-called axis of evil that George Bush, you know, was pushing. And since then, Syria had been, you know, obviously in this sort of what they called the axis of resistance, which means that people really didn't like, you know, the United States government really didn't like the fact that Syria and Iran were working very closely. Syria was supporting Hezbollah significantly in Lebanon. And that was something that was, you know, just an absolute unacceptable position in Washington. And, you know, throughout the dying days of the old government, they had sort of maintained the sort of resistance posture. You know, and folks can discuss like how much of that was real and how much of that was, you know, pandering to particular demographics. But regardless, right, throughout that whole time, Syria was a conduit for Palestinian organizations. Some other ones were being attacked and murdered by the Syrian government. Particularly, I would say Hezbollah, critically, they were very close partners to the extent that Hezbollah then ended up fighting on behalf of the Syrian government inside Syria when they thought that this sort of, partnership was facing an existential threat. Incidentally, they were right. And in this past week, one of the things that Syria did, which I think, you know, we have to understand within the context of it being removed from a state sponsor of terror thing, is it has started intercepting Iranian weapons shipments to Hezbollah, some of which historically have gone through Syria. So just this last week, they claim to have caught and stopped a weapon shipment to Hezbollah. And so now it's went from being a conduit for those weapons to being a way of stopping those weapons from getting through. So that's, I would say, a key piece in which like the United States is looking for what it defines as terrorism.
And if one understood what I'm about to say about al-Sharaa, the president, you might understand that recent turn of loyalties, right? So in as a result of U.S. bombardment, you and I have talked about this too, right? Like, what does actual bombing the crap out of countries create inside of those countries in terms of resistance, right? We talk about the rise of ISIS, the rise of al-Qaeda, and affiliated groups of which Ahmed al-Sharaa was a leader of such group, which actually overthrew the last regime of al-Assad. But then when he ascended to power, he publicly broke ties with al-Qaeda and other groups of such. Yeah, am I tracking this all correctly?
Yeah, that's spot on. You know, he was literally a member of al-Qaeda in Syria, eventually sort of splintered off into a different group that, you know, to their credit, did fight ISIS pretty regularly. So it's not like they're just, you know, the same, you know, like ISIS with a fake nose and mustache kind of thing. But, you know, that's not to say that they didn't have deep ideological agreements, right? And they did. And I think one thing that often gets misunderstood in terms of how the, like, Islamist political orientations in the Middle East are understood in the United States is that historically there are two trends there, right? There's the sort of Iran-oriented, like, resistance Islamists, right, which are often but not always Shia, Hamas, for example, is a Sunni movement that is sort of part of that resistance orientation. And then there's like the, in Arabic we call them the Takfiris, like the like more Al-Qaeda fundamentalist Sunni orientation, which is the Al-Qaeda's, ISIS, whatever type of groups. And you know, people sort of lump Islamist in as like this one thing, and it's not, right? It's multiple different movements actively at war with each other, right? So like Hamas, for example, has waged a very active campaign to eradicate Al-Qaeda and ISIS in Gaza, for example, right? They do not get along at all. They're mortal enemies. And historically, that like fundamentalist Al-Qaeda orientation, you know, it's weird because like those are the ones responsible for 9/11. And historically, those have been the US allied groups, right? Like the US has funded and supported and protected those groups for decades, right? Think about Afghanistan, for example, where, okay, yeah, we went to war with the Taliban, but we created the Taliban, right, as a way to underscore like resistance to the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. And that's not dissimilar from what's happening now in Syria, where, you know, we're sort of used to thinking about these groups as like enemies of the United States, but historically, they're really not. They're very happy to work with the United States. And that's actually what we're seeing now, that the sort of like, you know, ISIS aligned or Al-Qaeda light, you know, the Syrian government has become, is very, very happy, right, to work within the dictates of like the Western capitalist order. And one thing that we're seeing right now, for example, is that the Western countries are working very closely with Syria to build pipelines or to restore existing Syrian oil pipelines to be able to divert oil away from the Strait of Hormuz. So Syria is playing a really critical role in trying to sort of undermine the card that Iran is playing right now, so that if Syria can get pipelines to run through the country out into the Mediterranean, then they would be less reliant on the Strait of Hormuz. So they're working very closely with Gulf oil states, with Western oil companies, et cetera, to get that to happen. And as a result, you know, in this latest round of strikes, Iran has for the first time struck Syria. So, you know, we're seeing this like new order develop very quickly.
My eyes are going all over the place. I'm trying to think of where to go next.
Sorry, it's because I'm yapping too much and I'm
No,
talking
you're
about
not.
too
You're
many
yapping
things.
exactly the right amount. It's part of why I love to have you here. And I learn so much, and my listeners are learning so much. And then me and my little organizer brain sort of goes, I'm like, okay, you have to focus on one thread. The first thing my brain always does is go hashtag petty. And as we were talking about Al-Sharasi, I was like, oh, it's kind of like when folks on the left run on platforms of Free Palestine and Black Lives Matter and then forget we exist once they're in office.
Yeah.
Anywho. If to your point, right? So if we're talking historically, where the United States supports and or creates groups that operate in that region in U.S. interests, and we pretend to be friends, doesn't it almost always go bad at some point?
Yes.
Like almost always, then we end up fighting the groups that we created. Any reason to think that's not going to go bad in Syria too? Like I just.
No, it's gonna be fine. This time, I just need one more
Said every alcoholic
fundamentalist
ever. Just one more to
militia
be fine.
advancing my interest. Just one more. I can stop any time. Yeah, it's gonna be a disaster. It always, I mean, not even most of the time, always, right? That this blowback is unavoidable, and particularly I would say in the Middle East, where like the attempt to create radical pro well, radical is the wrong word, extremist proxies for the United States always ends up hitting against this one particular problem, which is for whatever the United States tries to do to reorganize the region in its image, a cornerstone of that is always Israeli regional hegemony. And people will always hate the United States for that. So there's no way to get out of that without, you know, if you're creating extremists, they're going to hate you for that. So this, yeah, it's a strategy that is inevitably, inexorably, by the laws of history, bound to backfire. And it will. Like that. I mean, I'm sure it already has on some level, but it's going to get worse.
I'm going to ask you a question that I'm pretty positive is a big question, but I'm going to ask it to you anyway. And I'm going to ask it like it's not that big of a question because that tends to be what I do to you. We don't hear much about, or I don't anyway, about Al-Qaeda or ISIS anymore. Like if I feel like it was always in the headlines and now it's not in the headlines anymore. How come?
I mean, I think it's no longer convenient to U.S. empire, right? And again, this goes back to what I was saying earlier, which, you know, might be a bit of a convoluted history lesson. I apologize for that, but I think it's really important for folks to understand that historically the United States and al-Qaeda type groups are actually allies. They are not enemies. And I think there has been a long desire to get that back. And now that they're sort of willing to play friends again, you know, this so-called threat is not even, you know, it's being downplayed significantly. And, you know, like, folks should remember the extent to which people talked about the fear of ISIS in Syria as being this, like, terrible, horrifying existential threat and needed to be stamped out. One of the things that Trump, you know, attacked his opponents on was that ISIS was reemerging in Syria. ISIS is now fully back. And that's, I don't mean like in the government because they're similar to ISIS. I mean that literally ISIS has now like established significant areas of autonomy inside Syria. But nobody cares because it no longer fuels the narrative that they needed. They don't want to be attacking Syria right now. They want to be supporting Syria. They don't want to be focusing the attention on these types of groups. They want to be focusing attention on Iran and Hamas and Hezbollah. And so it doesn't make sense to be pointing out the enemies of those groups as being threats. They actually want to support those people because enemy of my enemy. And we're going to go down this loop again, you know, inevitably and unavoidably. And, you know, you were talking about the irony of like these groups and how they position themselves. And I think like one of the great al-Shara'a ironies is that, you know, until very recently, he was hiding his real name. He used like his nom de guerre, right? His fake war name, and that was Muhammad al-Julani, Muhammad from the Golan, specifically naming the Golan Heights, the area occupied by Israel and Syria, as like a way to kind of build popular support. And now here he is, president of the country, in a moment where Syria is gobbling up whatever is left of the Golan Heights that Syria still controlled, and he's not doing anything about it. He's not even trying to do anything about it. And I think I mentioned to you, right, that I was in Syria last year, and I saw some of this myself, that there aren't even Syrian troops stationed where, like, on the border of where the Israelis have taken in the Golan. There's nothing. They're not even trying to stop it. And so, like, yeah, like, what a total sellout of that position, which, you know, it obviously infuriates Arabs, but endears yourself very much to Western interests, which is why I think that narrative has vanished entirely.
Sort of flashing back on when you and I were first speaking, when the Al-Assad regime was overthrown, and it was sort of like that fable. I do like to tell it a lot, the we'll see fable, right? Oh, mm-hmm. the horse comes. Oh, how lucky you got a horse. We'll see. Oh, you broke the arm. You know what I mean? Like, and that's where you were at. You were like, we'll see. Mm-hmm. and we are seeing. All right, I want to move on to the West Bank, where dozens of Israeli settlers stormed a Palestinian village, set fires to mosques and buildings. They set fire to mosques and buildings, y'all, because that's where people were running for safety. They also set Palestinian farmland and olive groves ablaze. I just always want to return to the fact, right, we're watching the Gazification. It's in full effect, not even like the beginning of the Gazification. The Gazification of the West Bank is in full effect, while the Gazification of Gaza continues in a brutal and bloody manner, because all of our eyes are diverted to Iran. quite frankly, I mean, I'm guessing that the conversation you and I just had about Syria, my listeners are like, oh yeah, Syria.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's an absolute horror show what's happening in the West Bank right now, and that's not to discount what's happening in Gaza, where the ceasefire basically doesn't exist at this point. I think another 50 people were killed just in the last few days by Israeli attacks. But the West Bank is, you know, I'm sure folks saw, you know, last week, I think it was, maybe it was the week before, once again, my brain is soup, that Ro Khanna was in the West Bank and attacked by a group of armed settlers.
We ran out of time to talk about it. Thank you for bringing that back.
I definitely, like, I remember getting off the call last time and be like, oh, we never talked about Ro. It's kind of weird. If you haven't watched the video, I cannot recommend strongly enough that you watch the video. It's bananas, right? This group of people basically mocking and threatening a sitting member of Congress with his entourage, you know, like the security officers and whatever. They look like soldiers, right? But they're not. They're just armed settlers, which, you know, set off a firestorm, right, in a certain whatever, you know, like a the Israeli government tried to do a bunch of damage control about it. Ro Khanna came out of it, I think, you know, basically talking about how completely, I think he was genuinely shocked. You know, I think he was genuinely surprised that that level of impunity exists in the West Bank. And like, yeah, I mean, it tells you something about how much Congress is insulated from the reality on the ground in the West Bank. But like, I don't know, good that he finally saw what things are actually like. Imagine what it's like. And he said this, to his credit, you know, this is what happened to me as a member of Congress. Imagine what it's like for your average Palestinian, right? It's got to be 100 times worse. And it is. And I think it's particularly fascinating to see that as a result of that, you know, I was expecting the Israelis to do some damage control, which, you know, Netanyahu went out and said, like, oh, these weren't even settlers. You know, this was like a group of youth, like, you know, a bunch of like young hooligans, you know, ignoring the fact that this is a well-funded and well-established group that actually receives subsidies from the Israeli state, that absolutely operates in the West Bank, that has historically cooperated with Israeli soldiers. And again, the video shows that the IDF shows up and they like just, you know, they're like chatting and having cigarettes with the armed settlers that are detaining Ro Khanna. They're not doing anything to stop it. And so
that reminds me of South Africa.
Yes, it's literally, it's the exact same dynamic. And in many ways, you know, according to South Africa and anti-apartheid activists themselves, worse, right? But that exact same dynamic of the state colluding with sort of local vigilante groups. Also, Jim Crow, like, you know, I'm halfway through a book on radical reconstruction, and it's very similar to what, like, the Klan was doing in the South in the, you know, late 1800s. So,
and what the FBI is doing right now with white
knights. That's right.
Nothing,
exactly. Nothing new under the sun. But I would have thought that it would have at least led to, like, the Israeli state sort of restraining settler violence for a little while for optics, but it actually went the other way. Right. What we're seeing is an increase in settler violence over these last couple of weeks, just to sort of demonstrate their ongoing impunity. Right. I think a group of settlers stole a sheep just a few days ago. And when the IDF showed up to like sort of mediate the dispute, they just killed the Palestinians who had raised the issue of the sheep being stolen from them. So like, you know, they're raiding and setting fire to homes at the same level or more than they were before. A real just absolute horror show in the West Bank while new settlements continue to be constructed at a ever increasing rate.
And I will also just say that the other thing that the Israeli government said is, well, he should have arranged his visit through us. He arranged it through Palestinians. So I don't, you know, this was all his fault. Doesn't he understand the way things work around these parts?
Totally. Yeah. And I love that the argument that like Republican congressmen and others were giving was like, oh, well, that's, imagine like, you know, a French delegation coming to visit the U.S. border and being surprised that they're like detained by the like border guards. And it's like, well, first of all, France isn't completely funding every single nickel of the U.S. border apparatus. If it was, it would probably be reasonable for them to come visit it, you know, but yeah, just a really absurd.
We're going to go out on this note, Samer. You know what else I don't hear about enough? And that is resistance by the Palestinian themselves, because I feel like we do a lot of coverage, you know, on the assaults. The reality is that Palestinians on the ground are organizing, they are fighting back, they are resisting, they continue resisting. I mean, that's part of what continues to fuel Israeli aggression, because they have the Palestinians have the audacity to resist in a way that inspires freedom fighters all over the world.
Yeah, I mean, the resilience of the Palestinian people continues to be an inspiration to everybody, and a horror that they have to endure. You know, like, it's the fact that they continue to fight under these circumstances is remarkable, truly remarkable, and almost inconceivable when you consider the odds stacked against them. And again, this is a thing that, you know, as I'm working my way through, and by the way, highly recommend the Eric Foner book on Reconstruction. If folks haven't read it, I'm slowly working my way through it. One of the things that I got to just this weekend was how local Black communities being terrorized by the Klan were building up a sort of like militia response, right? Because the state certainly wasn't protecting them. The systems of government, the judges and whatever, weren't doing anything to protect them. And so they had no choice but to sort of arm themselves and push back the Klan. And they did in really effective, really powerful ways. And, you know, that courage and that strength to stand up against a combination of vigilante and state violence is a remarkable thing that speaks to the strength of a community trying to protect itself. And there's only so much that can be accomplished in the context of every single card being stacked against you, right? Like you cannot, you know, you cannot build sufficient power to stop that level of terror, right? By like sort of like local organizing in the context of an entire state apparatus and, you know, like an infinite amount of resources being deployed against you. In the context of all of that, nevertheless, Palestinians continue to resist and hold on to their land and push back against settler violence. Gazans continue to live and thrive to the extent that's possible under a brutal Israeli occupation and assault that's happening every single day. And I don't think anybody in the sort of Israeli political modeling, you know, of how this would have played out, expected this level of Palestinian resilience, expected that after years of genocide and forced starvation and, you know, the chopping up of West Bank territory, of daily settler violence, that the Palestinian people refuse to leave. They refuse to stop fighting. They refuse to give up. They refuse to cede an inch of their land to anybody who is trying to take it from them. And they refuse to be anything but proud Palestinians calling for a country and a state that belongs to them and their ancestors and will always belong to them and will one day be theirs again. And that's a, you know, it's a thing that keeps us going out here for sure. And, you know, just to say the sort of small echo of that we're seeing here in the United States, if folks haven't seen it yet, one thing that my org, the Center for Constitutional Rights, has been really involved in is Mahmoud Khalil, this Palestinian organizer in Colombia who, you know, has been attempted to be made an example of by the state. Again, every possible form of attack that they can use against him, they've tried. You know, they imprisoned him. They whisked him away 1,000 miles from his pregnant wife, his, you know, separated from his newborn child for 100 days at threat of deportation. Right now, right in the middle of deportation proceedings based on zero grounds, what Mahmoud Khalil is doing in response to all of that is not to like make himself smaller. It's to go on the offensive. And, you know, in last couple of weeks, Mahmoud Khalil has filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration, and not just the Trump administration, not just Trump, Stephen Miller, you know, Kristi Noem, Mark Wayne Mullen, Marco Rubio, all of them named individually in the suit, but also the Heritage Foundation, who wrote Project 2025 and Project Esther, also Canary Mission, that, you know, shadowy group that tries to like dox Palestinian supporters, Bitar, the wild right wing Israeli organization that like has been attacking Palestinians across the United States. He's gone on the offensive against every single one of those groups in this moment where he is at his most vulnerable. And I think that tells us something about the strength and resiliency that we need to show in this moment, that like hiding and making yourself smaller doesn't protect any of us. This is an opportunity to go on the offensive, to go hand in hand with all the communities that the United States is trying to oppress and punish and repress right now and push back. So if folks hadn't heard about that case, or even if you had, I really highly, highly recommend sign up for updates from CCR to get information on what's happening with that case. I'm really hoping that we can do something on the West Coast soon with Mahmoud. We're working on it. So please stay tuned for that. You know, I think it's a remarkable thing, and I couldn't be prouder to be working on it.
I'll let your girl if that happens. And see, on the West Coast, you see, that's why I said you smarter than me. You were spending your downtime reading about Reconstruction in the South. I spend my downtime reading Murder Mysteries by Ruth Ware. So
that sounds great. That sounds great.
It was sitting there the other night. I was getting ready actually to pick up KSA Lyman. And I was like, I just need it all to go for a moment. You know, just for a moment. I'm going to skip Resistance and Residence actually because it's a repeat because we go on a fun drive tomorrow. And so I'm going to ask you actually some more questions for just a couple more minutes. Hamas has announced the election of Khalil al-Hayya as the new head of its political bureau. This is the first, I believe, in this position since 2024, when Yahya Sinwar, when Sinwar was murdered by the Israelis. Folks listening to this show might remember when that happened. Who is he, and what is the significance of this new leadership in the midst of the conversations that aren't really happening anymore, except for in the imagination of Trump, about how we get to the end of the genocide, which is supposed to include Hamas basically disarming and going away?
That's right. There's so many pieces here, and I'm afraid I probably won't get through all of it in whatever few minutes we have left. But just to note, the Hamas dissolved the government in Gaza around the same time, which I think was a really actually masterful play, basically to sort of force the hand of the other people who have been withholding aid to Gaza for all of this time. But this election of El-Hayez is a fascinating one, and I think a really important indicative example, again, of why this type of like destroy resistance movements through military force doesn't work, or frankly to destroy a group or an ideology or a sort of push in any form doesn't work. It's not dissimilar to frankly what we saw with the U.S. attack on Iran, where the hope was that an ongoing military assault and attack, a brutal military campaign against these people would somehow force them into a more submissive posture and make them more amenable to U.S. positions or whatever. And what often ends up happening, history teaches us this, is that the opposite happens, that when you attack like a broad political movement, what that results in is that the various political tendencies within that movement change their orientations, and the relative power of those people change too. And so what happened in Iran, as is happening right now with Hamas, is that the moderates, the sort of accommodationists, have been proven wrong, right? Have been objectively proven wrong by the idea that, look, we can work with outside powers, we can negotiate, whatever. Those people have all been murdered, which means that what ends up happening is the more hardline factions, the more kind of, the more militant orientation, the more there is no compromise, it's a struggle to the death type people, end up being the ones that take over leadership of these movements. We saw it in Iran as the IRGC took over, and now Al-Haya, who has been the sort of in exile leader of Hamas for quite some time, but is also known as one of the hardliners within Hamas. There has historically been real friction between the more moderate and the more hardline elements of that movement. And historically, the ones in exile were the ones who tended to be more moderate. Now, the top exile leader for Hamas has become the overall leader of the party, and he is known as a pretty strong hardliner. And so what has the U.S. and Israel accomplished in terms of degrading Hamas? They've actually made it less amenable to a negotiated solution, less amenable to a sort of accommodationist orientation towards Israel and the United States, in a moment where, according to the United States' own estimates, Hamas is just about as militarily powerful as it was when this war began. And so, weathering 3 years of genocide, Hamas has come out of it, unsurprisingly, with an almost infinite number of recruits who are willing to do anything to fight back against the people who, massacred their families and destroyed their homes and their schools and their mosques. Unsurprisingly, empire in its attempt to sort of stamp out movements through violence only engender more violence as a result.
Our guest today has been Samer Arabi, Associate Director of Political Education and Research at the Center for Constitutional Rights. He's also a member of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, AROC, and co-founder of AROC Action.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.